Welcome back to Death by Champagne, the podcast here to keep you up at night. We have a really exciting episode for you guys this week. We had the opportunity to interview Rachel Monroe, author of our most recent book series, Savage Appetites. We ask Rachel some of our lingering questions about the book, along with some discussions about obsession, her career as a journalist, and future projects. This episode contains foul language, discussions about murder, women in crime, and books. We'll do our best to stay on track, but the bottles are popped. Hey guys.
Hi, welcome back to Death by Champagne.
We have a super special guest here with us today.
We do. And I thought today, as I was thinking about all of our episodes, like I always do after they're done, that we don't introduce ourselves at the beginning of our episodes, ever. So unless you've come in from about episode 60, you probably have no idea whose voice is whose. So I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Olivia.
And our guest with us today is Rachel Monroe, author of Savage Appetites.
Hello. I'm very happy to be talking with you guys today.
I feel like our listeners are definitely going to get sick of me saying this because I do it every time someone agrees to an interview. I'm like, oh my God, someone wants to talk to us and doesn't want to yell at us.
There is like nothing, the dream of writing a book when you're like sitting alone in your house writing a book, feeling like a crazy person, the dream is that like want to talk about it with you later. So, you know, you're living my dream.
That is great. We said the same thing to Bruce Goldfarb. We got to interview him last week, and I went on and on about how I didn't reach out to him even because I was like, he is probably really busy. I don't know what our schedule is like. And he just messaged me and was like, hey, when can I be on your show? And I was like, right now.
I feel like that's kind of the consensus with every author we've interviewed so far. It's like, of course I want to talk about the thing I spent time writing a book on, like,
because you do just feel like, you know, I guess maybe it's similar doing a podcast, I don't know, but you can sometimes feel like, am I talking to anybody other than myself? Maybe that's a nice thing about a podcast, is you have somebody else, you're like, well, at least we're talking to each other.
Right. So. Yes, it definitely feels the same way. I think there are weeks when I wonder, like, who is even listening to this? And then I'll get a message. And someone's like, oh my gosh, I read this thing, and then I found another article, and I'm like, all right, okay, we are good. This is working. So, Savage Appetites was our first series back after a four-month-long break, and I think the story of how we kind of came to it, I think I heard about the book first from listening to You're Wrong About, and another apology in advance, I'm going to mention You're Wrong About 1,900 times like I have in every episode of this series since. I think I heard one of the episodes that you were on and talked about your book, and I got it, and I think I told Bruce I was getting my hair cut when I started reading it, and I was just sitting there by myself, wet towel on my head, started reading the book, and I just texted Olivia and was like, this is it, I'm going to buy it, drop it off on your doorstep, we have to read this. And I think we read it from November, it was either like October or November, all the way into January. And like every other night, I feel like she would be like, have you read this part? We need to have a long discussion about this. So for every part of the series that came together as an episode, there were probably six side conversations of like, look this up. How do you feel about this person?
So it was a very, conversations.
Yes, it was. The epitome of the relationship or the experience you want when you read something good and you have something to talk about and you're like, I need to share this.
That's really cool to hear. I think there's like a funny thing that there's one impulse that publishing people have where they sort of want they want a book that has a really clear takeaway, I guess, kind of like, you know, like the Malcolm Gladwell thing where you're like, did you know that it takes 10,000 hours of practice to become an expert? You know, like just like something that could fit almost into a tweet or something. And I've always, my tendency is I like to write books that just make people have a thousand questions. And I don't want to answer most of those questions because I don't have an answer, but I just want us all to be like having the same question together. And then, so yeah, the idea that, that I think, like, if I had a goal for the book, it would be that people, that it would inspire people to like call their friends and have an argument with them or a discussion with them. So that's good. That makes me feel a little bit like I did my job.
You definitely did. I think every person that has reached out to us after the series or during it, it's been the same thing of like, I didn't know this, or how are we going to talk about this next time? There's been a lot of, we've had awesome feedback and people tagging us that they bought the book, which is so good. Cause I'm like, yes, now you can live in the same world that we do.
Yeah.
And I have kind of a question later that is along the same lines of like, everything I've read since then is now like painted in the lens of Savage Appetites, and how am I looking at this? Is there a different angle I could be seeing, or is there something I'm missing? So it's definitely a long lasting journey into like, why are you consuming the media that you are? What are you taking away from this? What's your motive? Olivia, do you want to take the first one since I kind of shoved it in there for you?
Yeah, definitely. So I actually read the interview today that you did with Chris O'Connell in 2017. And obviously if we weren't intimidated by interviewing anyone before, we definitely are now. That interview was really well done. Learned a lot, I feel like, from it. So how would you, I guess, summarize, if you'd like, to this point in your career, getting to the point of writing nonfiction and true crime with that?
I think, you know, it's funny. I think looking back from the perspective of now, I think for a long time, I've always been a person who has been fascinated by things and, you know, like true crime and mysteries, or, you know, terrible stories has been one of those things. But I had maybe like a lot of suspicion of my own interests, if that makes sense. Like, it's like, these are weird things to be interested in. Nobody else is interested in them. Like, if I start talking about it, then I'll just go on and on and on. And I have to be careful not to do that because, then people will give me funny looks. And so it took me a long time, I think, to figure out that the things that I was interested in, that I could be like professionally interested in them, I guess. Like, not only could I tell other people about it, but like that there were many other people who had found the things that, that I wanted to stay up all night reading about. Other people maybe would have the same reaction. So it's a little bit of a circuitous path. I sometimes talk to young writers now who are like, I can think of this one guy who was a sophomore in college when he reached out to me and he was like, I'm behind. And I'm like, dude, I did not start doing any of this until I was like 30, you know? So, which is now, I'm 38, and I'm just like, 30 is like nothing. You're a little baby. So it started out with me. I started out, like, I always knew I wanted to be a writer. I went to grad school. I did an undergraduate degree and kind of focused on creative writing and then went to grad school. But that whole time I thought I was going to write fiction because being a reporter seemed to me like, I don't know. I just had the sense that you had to be like really tough and like, you know how to talk to the mayor or something, and that you had to be very objective. And I have always, I just react to the world from an emotional place, and any kind of writing that doesn't acknowledge that in some way seemed to me to be false, or at least it felt like a false kind of writing for me, not the kind of writing I wanted to do. And so I didn't, and there wasn't just a ton of long form writing out there, I guess, also, like, in my early 20s, or at least not a lot that I was exposed to. I think right now the internet has led to a proliferation of places where that kind of writing can happen, which I think is really cool. But so it wasn't until like after grad school that I slowly started trying to pretend that I could be a reporter, and I found that it really suited me, I think, just because I'm a really curious person, and I'm, like, super nosy, and I love asking people about their lives, and having an excuse to ask people really personal details, and so it just really, I really loved it. And it's funny, the first piece of reporting that I ever did was a piece, was basically I just wanted to see the Frances Wilson Lee's nutshell studies, which were in Baltimore. And they won't let just anybody, like, waltz in and see them. You have to have an excuse. And so I was like, oh, I'm a reporter with a Baltimore City paper. I'm going to write an article about them. And I think I emailed an editor there, and he very nicely was like, you can't just write an article about, you need to have, like, a tag for your article, like, why now? And then, fortunately, this woman, Susan Marks, was doing a documentary about them, and I was like, I'm writing about this documentary. You must let me in to see them. And they did. And so it really was, like, in a funny way, it all comes, I don't know, it's funny to, like, look back and be like, oh, I was working on this book, like, way before I ever had any idea that I was going to be any kind of reporter, whether, like, way, way, way before I ever thought of myself as a person who would ever write a book. My interests were the same. It just took me a long time to, like, take them seriously and take myself seriously, if that makes sense.
Yeah absolutely.
I fully relate to all of that with being in the dark things and not knowing when to, you know, kind of stop talking about it around the people who maybe don't want to hear it because you just, like, want everyone to know.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that and the idea that figuring out that something that you're interested in, just even giving that a chance to have a platform and an audience, mm-hmm. is like, oh, the second you put it out there, no matter how skeptical you are, people are probably going to answer you just because, I mean, how many people are there in the world? There's no chance that someone else isn't interested. And I think having a podcast, I mean, it's the exact same thing for us. The idea, we started doing interviews and completely kind of switched the way that we formatted the show just because an author reached out to us and was like, I saw that you tagged me in this thing and I haven't talked about this book in a long time. If you want to know anything, here I am. And I was just like, oh, there it is. The thing I said we could never do just, like, mm-hmm. threw itself at us. So I can't imagine at this point that we have any listeners who are coming to this episode without listening to at least part of our series first or reading Savage Appetites. But either way, if they've listened to all of our episodes, they've only heard about the specifics of the book through, like, all of the filters of our construction and all of the side stories that we added into it. Like, the first things that came to mind when we did the Victim series, the Netflix special on the Cecil Hotel had just come out, and I was like, okay, this is the thing that's, like, making a hurricane in my brain is reading this chapter and watching this show at the same time. So outside of our viewpoints, do you want to give our listeners kind of, like, your elevator speech on what Savage Appetites is about?
You'd think I'd, like, have a really good elevator speech by now, but I don't. I mean, I guess it started in some ways with me being curious about my own desire to consume these tragic, upsetting, bloody stories, and, like, finding a lot of comfort in them personally. I was like, well, those are two emotional tones that don't really match up. So what's going on there? And then turning, you know, to the internet to see what else had been written about it and finding myself pretty dissatisfied with the answers, like a lot of the things that people will say about generalizations that people will make about, like, women, as if that's a monolithic category, seemed really, I don't know, like, reductive and didn't account for the complexity that I felt within myself and the complexity that I knew was out there in other people. So I was like, okay, I want to think about obsession. Has always been really fascinating to me. Like, why do we get obsessed with the things that we get obsessed with? You know, when an interest, or a desire goes beyond sort of, like, what is considered normal or reasonable. Great things can come from that, and also, like, really terrible things can come from that. And both of those, I think, are really fascinating to me and kind of scary, too. So I knew I wanted to write about those energies, and it just took me a little while to, like, realize that a number of the stories that I had written about or just followed in my years as a writer and a reporter and a person who like stays up late and Googles things, were all like circling around this same question. Like, why do we get obsessed with these stories? Why do women in particular tend to get obsessed with these stories? What are we getting out of them? And then also, what is that obsession? How does it live in the broader world? How does it shape society? You know, how does it shape our politics and our understanding of the world and what's scary and who needs protection and what does protection look like? What do we need protection against? What does justice look like? How do you get justice? All those questions, I think, are really active in this world of true crime. So this is like a very long elevator ride.
I feel like we're cut from the same cloth. I wrote that specific section that I referenced about Elisa Lam and the Cecil documentary, and I told Olivia at the beginning, I was like, I gave myself 2 pages to cover this, and then I did it in 6. So there's no cutting down on the details when it is the thing that you like can't stop obsessing about yourself. So exactly. I feel that on a deep level.
Good.
Kind of in the same note, was there like a moment in your life or your career, like what was like your light bulb to like, this is a book. These stories that I have collected are going to roll together into one thing.
You know, I did have a moment, which is funny, and I should go back in my like journal because I am an obsessive journaler, because I have a terrible memory, because I'm sure I wrote it down, but I remember being at the bar with a friend, and I had been wanting to write something about true crime for a while and not quite knowing how to approach it. And then I think I was at this bar with these women that I didn't know all that well and was telling them about something that they mentioned randomly made me think about Frances Glessner Lee, and I started explaining her. And I had also recently been thinking about the Manson case and the folks who were obsessed with that and the Columbiners, the girls who were obsessed with Columbine. And there was something about where I just saw that those three things were not three separate things, but like three sides of the same, phenomenon. And it's just, you know, since I wrote a book about it, I'm like, oh yeah, of course. But at the time it hadn't occurred to me. And it was one of those, really was like a strange moment of once you're explaining something to somebody else, you don't realize that you understand it until you're halfway through the sentence. And I was like, wait, what?
You're like, I do know it all.
Yeah. And I just had been like thinking about this stuff for 10 years without like realizing that what I was really thinking about or that I was thinking about this. These things all seemed like different to me. And then I was like, oh no, they're different, but they're also the same. And that's kind of what you need for a book, right? You need things that are like different but the same, or the same but different.
Yeah, I liked how much feeding into, like, that weaving the web of obsession and putting it in that viewpoint of what happens. Like, you know, there is no rhyme or reason to each story. They all have different outcomes. They all have different circumstances. They all have, like, different flavors of motivation and, like, all of their emotions that were attached to it. But I think that was, like, the main thing that I took away from it was both that there is no one path. For, like, you know, like you said, they're all separate, but then also there doesn't have to be an ending to any of these. The circumstances themselves become the story. And I feel like that's the leveling up. Like, level one of just like going home and watching Dateline is like, yep, I like true crime. And then level two is like, uh-oh, you find a podcast that has a lawyer on it, or you read the right long form article and you're like, oh, this is kind of bad, or this affects people in a way past like, a white blonde lady got murdered and I watched it on TV. Like, there becomes all of this stuff that's involved in it. And then 3 years later, you're two people that have a podcast, or in your case, you've written a book.
But I think that's like, that's one of my theories of obsession, is that what makes you feel obsessed with something is when it's not finished, when it feels like it's a circuit that isn't closed, it's not resolved. And whether that's like a case where, you know, the outcome, you know, it's like a cold case and we haven't figured out who the perpetrator was, or it's like been adjudicated, but maybe it's been adjudicated wrong, or, you know, like something like that where you're just sort of like, it's not finished yet. You know, if it felt finished, we could go home, but it like, it doesn't feel finished yet. And I think that's why we, and the criminal justice system, right? Like, I think that's something that another aspect of what, leads a lot of people to like get these stories, get your, their hooks in you. Cause you're just sort of like, this system is so, it's so incomplete, you know, at giving like anything that we would call justice or closure. It's just, it just doesn't. And so then you know, if you have the right kind of brain for it, like your brain goes in there and starts trying to like close that gap, you know, square the circle, like finish it up, and it just can't. And so you just keep spinning and spinning and spinning.
Yeah, that reminds me of a comment that I made during the series that people who don't like cold cases baffle me and almost like offend me, because I'm like, what? How do you not want to hear about someone's case who isn't finished, where even if we're going to afterwards debate what justice or closure means, like, you don't want to hear the story just because there's no answer? Like, that's not how this works.
No, but you'll see that, like, if you look at reviews of, yeah, true crime things where there isn't, like, sort of, that don't end in that classically, like, quote-unquote satisfying way of, like, here's the bad guy and here's the image of, like, the jail doors closing. You know, people will be like, wait, what? You know, I expected my closure. And it's just so, it's also just so untrue to the way that the world is, but I guess.
Yeah, I think that might be people seeking a version of things that they need for themselves. Like, that might be something that you're lacking in other parts of your life, or just like for whatever your motivation or reason is, you want to see something tied up in a bow at the end. Whereas I think so many of us are the complete opposite, like you said. We need the complete open road ahead of us of, like, what has not been done yet? Where are there holes? Let me find all the things that aren't done. And then stay up until 3 a.m.
Yeah, just being allowed to have that obsession, something that isn't over, that hasn't ended, and keep going and going. So we know now that you are into dark, morbid, creepy things. So did you, like, attending CrimeCon, was that solely for the book, or was that more personal? Like, is that something you wanted to do, or was that more to get research for the book, or kind of both?
I would say, I mean, everything for this book was so both for me, you know, and that was what was really confusing. I mean, I probably would not have spent the money to fly to Nashville and, like, stay in that very silly hotel, like the biggest hotel in the world, or second biggest, whatever. Biggest non-casino hotel in the world, I believe. If I couldn't justify it to myself as work, but then when I was there, I totally found myself like completely absorbed in the experience. And then every now and then I would sort of slingshot back and be like, wait, no, I'm here. Like, you know, trying to have a meta experience, right? Like, what, you know, what am I doing here? What is everybody else doing here? So, yeah, it was really overwhelming in that way. And I think in the book, I write about it. It's feeling almost like a binging experience in a way, which is complicated language to use. But, you know, the book does use the metaphor of appetite quite a bit. But just, you know, this thing that had existed, you know, the fascination with crime that had been so taboo in my head, I think, for a while. Like, what if I was in a place where I could have, you know, where it was just, this is what everybody has the same obsession, and there's as much of it as you want, you know, like too much. There's too much crime happening, too many crime stories. And yeah, it was too much. It ended up being too much.
We'll get to have our own experience with that COVID and world things willing in September. So I'm interested to report back to you how that goes for us. We are going to the one in London for the first time. So that'll be an entirely overwhelming experience of 24/7 crime for 3 days and international travel and jet lag thrown on top of it.
Yes. And you just see all sorts of different kinds of people. I mean, it's, you know, there were women there who were taking a very like kind of like bachelorette trip kind of attitude, which struck me as like very strange. But then you had people who were just like really lifetime advocates for a certain case that had never really gotten traction, and then realizing that, you know, hey, if I go there and like present this directly to people, like I could get somebody, whether it's a detective or whether it's like a podcaster, or just an amateur detective, like fascinated by this so that, you know, it could get the attention that it deserves. So it was really, yeah, it's fascinating.
Sounds like a delightful and disorienting experience. That's what I'm anticipating with it. So in a review of Savage Appetites for NPR, I read that Alana Massad talked about your ability to weave together stories that you were covering for the book with your own personal thoughts, kind of simultaneously evaluating your position as a consumer of the crime content, as well as presenting this overview of how it's affected other people. Is there anything in your life or work that pushed you to consider that motive or morality? Because I think a lot of producers, directors, podcasters, just people who read books, like, we don't ever consider, is this my story to tell? Who authorized the publication of this book? Who is making a profit off of this TV show? Like, did you have any kind of epiphany of coming to a place of evaluating morality in the genre?
I think some of that came from just doing reporting on actual cases. I haven't written a ton of long-form pieces. By this point, I have written a ton of long-form pieces. not all of them have been about crime, but I think there was something about that firsthand experience of being in a courtroom and like hearing victims' relative give a victim impact statement, you know, to the man who murdered her child. And just the, like, there's, once you've been through something like that or talking to somebody whose partner has been murdered, or now I'm just like in my head going through like a slideshow of these like really, almost like traumatic by proxy experiences that I had as a reporter. There's something about the really indelible reality of those moments where you see how, I don't know, it's just impossible to think of these stories as merely entertainment or something that's happening as at a distance, or, you know, some of the issues that I have with true crime that I'm more critical of. At least it was impossible for me to not think about the ethical dimensions and the bigger picture and the like humans and the real human pain that's like at the heart of all of these stories. And so I'm really grateful that I came to it like from that grounding, because it just didn't allow me to ever forget that reality, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of validity to taking the next step and like having experiences that, like, as I've said 100 times, like, we're not journalists. We've talked to people who are journalists, who are authors. Occasionally we'll have a little bit of conversation with someone who's a little bit closer to a case. But I think that is lost on a lot of people, that for everyone who's involved, it's just reality. Before it's entertainment, 10 years later, it was the worst night of someone's life. And I think the timing of having Savage Appetites, all of the publicity that came out about the Cecil Hotel documentary, like, is it ethical? Is it doing what it says it's doing? And just tons of media right now that came out at the same time. We had a lot of opportunity to be like, how would I have thought about this last year instead of right now? Would I have taken this the same way, or would I have just watched it with my snack and not ever had the thought period?
Yeah. But I will say, like, the other side, the flip side of that, or maybe not the flip side, but, like, another important aspect of it to me is, like, also finding a way to, like, honor and respect the part of me that really does get something out of true crime. Even sometimes shows that I would be embarrassed about or would find it indefensible, you know? And rather than, like, I tried really hard, I think, to, like, walk a line to not, to consider all those ethical dimensions and the political impact of these stories that we tell and which stories we tell and which stories we don't tell. But then also to, like, not scold myself, really, and not scold anybody else. I don't know. I think that there's, like, there can be sort of a knee-jerk response to, and you see this, like, a lot out there in the world. It's just like, oh, true crime is, like, trashy and voyeuristic, and anybody who would like it is a trashy, voyeuristic person. And I was just like, you know, that's not true either. People are bringing real emotional needs. You know, there's those needs, there's something real that's being met here. And so trying to, like, hold both of those realities in my head, you know, like, that this is, these are, like, real stories that happen to real people, and also, like, the people consuming them are getting something out of them, and doesn't benefit anybody to, like, dismiss that. I don't know, just, like, empathy in all, as many directions as possible.
Yes, absolutely. I think if you could get to a point where, when you're watching that, like, again, I come back to you're wrong about, I think it was Sarah Marshall that was like, I think we can let people watch Oxygen and also wonder about what's okay. Like, exactly. Nobody has to feel bad about going home and watching Forensic Files when you're tired. Like, you can just use what you're going to use. And there was another moment in that NPR interview, I think it was in that one or that review, that she mentioned consuming some piece of true crime media and then needing to tell her therapist about it. And her therapist's answer was, maybe you're fascinated by violence because it's something you feel like you're so incapable of. So on the, you know, the flip side of finding something that you identify with in a defender, a killer, like, maybe it's something you outright recognize that you don't have. So it's something you don't understand. So you just keep watching it over and over.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Or like are afraid of, right? That's like, we rehearse our fears, I think, through these stories and try to, yeah, something that we don't understand. I mean, I think that's why people are so fascinated by stories of, like, psychopathy or just, like, aberrant psychologies. It's just sort of like, what would it be like to have a mind like that? What, just trying to understand the things that are sort of ununderstandable in a way.
Yeah, definitely. So our next question kind of goes in line with that a little bit. I think you were super unbiased throughout your writing. So I think you definitely, you know, walked that line very elegantly with, you know, not being judgmental, not making people feel bad for what they're reading or doing, but also making people question it, like, you know, two sides of that coin. So out of the topics, you know, detective, victim, defender, killer, were any of them easier or more difficult to research and kind of get into the minds of the individual that you were covering?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I think in some ways they were all difficult in their own way. I would say maybe, I don't know if it was easiest or not, but Defender, the story of Laurie Davis and Damien Eccles and the West Memphis Three, I think in some ways was like a breath of fresh air to research. I mean, first of all, there's like a ton out there, which is good and bad, right? You know, like, you could be like, well, now I need to pause writing this book for, like, 7 years so I can read everything that's ever been written about the history. But I did not do that. But it was just nice writing about somebody who, I think Laurie Davis is just, like, a really incredible person, and she was really generous with her time and very open to me. Like, a lot of, many of the other subjects of my book, like, I had either no contact with because they were dead or just like a difficult time contacting them or they, you know. And so it was easier in that way. And I think that that's like, in some ways, that's like more of a straightforwardly noble position. The idea of like, I'm going to spend my whole life like righting this wrong in the justice system. There's a real kind of like lovely moral clarity there. This guy has been imprisoned. You know, he's on death row for a crime he didn't do. As a motivation, like, that's pretty easy to understand. And I, you know, I don't know if I would be capable of going as far as she did. But it was like a pleasure to sort of spend time with her mind. And also cause I like knew that it had a relatively happy outcome. I think that probably would have been a hard case to come to, you know, when they're, you know, been in prison for 20 years or something and it seems like nothing's going to happen. That was probably a heartbreaking time, but coming to it at this time when, I don't know, I knew it worked out for them on some level. That was nice. And then maybe like the harder one, was the last section of the book, the section about the killer. I don't know. I mean, it's just like I was saying, it's important to extend empathy, or is an important part of my practice, right? To like empathize with these people that I'm writing about and not sort of hold them at a distance. And that's why one reason I put so much of myself in there, I wanted to like, I guess, try to serve as like a bridge for the reader and be like, okay, maybe this person that I'm writing about seems like they're extreme to you, or they're making decisions that you don't agree with, but I'm like halfway to them. And so if you can empathize with me, then like maybe I can be this bridge to having you empathize with them. And that's one thing when I'm writing about somebody like Frances Glessner Lee, you know, who was like a prickly old lady, and difficult, but then it's like a whole other thing when I'm writing about somebody who like fantasized at length about killing people, you know, and had like used a lot of Nazi imagery, like Lindsay in the killer section. And so just like, I don't know. I just remember like the practice of like steeping myself in her world, in her writings. I mean, she also was like, she was like the most prolific online person. So just every thought that she ever had, it seemed like was online. And looking at her like terrible, like My Little Pony Hitler art and reading, like, I mean, I was really fortunate in that as a reporter, because the court, she and the boy that she planned the mass shooting with, their only communications were on through Facebook Messenger. They never, as far as anybody knows, like talked on the phone or FaceTimed or Skyped or anything. Their entire relationship was over text, and that all of those chats were entered into the record. And it was like, you know, maybe a couple thousand pages of chats. And I read all of them, you know, cause how fortunate to like have a story, have somebody's like relationship there for you. You know, you can see the whole thing like happening before your eyes in writing. That's like really incredible. But it was also so dark because they would just, you know, sometimes they'd be complaining about their parents or talking about their depression, or like there was like a lot of sexting that I did not, I was like, I don't feel like I should be reading this. I did not read that. But then there was just a lot of them like fantasizing about killing people. And I think I write about this in the book, but at one point I was like reading it and they were fantasizing about, I was in the fancy new library in Halifax, and then they're describing the library and being like, we could kill people in the fancy new library in Halifax. And I just was like looking around me and, you know, all these like nice people around me and like my relationship with the world, and then like thinking, trying to inhabit their relationship with the world. And it really made me feel like pretty physically ill. Yeah, I mean, just like really, you know, like, you know, those ideologies and those mindsets are out there, but there's something about like really seeing it play out, like reading that much of it, is really too much.
Oh yeah. I can imagine that. I mean, that's a whole different game when you can imagine and maybe even read someone's manifesto, but like to really get into that full conversation between not just one person either, like to have two of them be saying the same thing and thinking the same thing. And yeah, that would be very heavy.
You also sort of see them like performing for each other. I don't know. You know, this is interesting. I like actually just got an email the other day from, two people, one of them, yeah, two people who were Lindsay's teachers, one in high school and one in college, have reached out to me and read the book. And one of them is actually like, I live in a tiny town in Texas of 2,000 people. And one of them is actually, like, in town right now. One of her teachers is. So we're going to meet up and talk about her. And I think it was really hard as a teacher to, like, see a troubled student. And I think they feel really conflicted about, you know, how things played out for her. It's like somebody going to prison.
For
life, for, you know, somebody
who
committed violence, but only, like, really heavily fantasized about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a big reckoning with myself. I mean, like, personally, outside the show and outside of, like, how I centered it, like, around reading the book, thinking back to, I'm from a small town in southern Illinois, and, like, remembering being in seventh grade, and people that I went to school with were drawing out the imagery on their notebooks and saying things of the same sort that you read between Lindsay and James Gamble. And it's just like, how are any of my teachers supposed to know that that kid wasn't going to do that? I think I felt a big pull between empathy, sympathy, and then repulsion of, like, yeah. I know so many kids who didn't actually mean that. They just needed the attention, or they were hearing their parents talk that way, so that's what they knew how to do. Yeah. Versus, I can't imagine, like, how I would feel about it if any of those people had actually gone on to try to plan something. Right. And I'm sure they've had the same thoughts, too. Some of them have, that they probably look back on how they acted in seventh and eighth grade, and they're horrified at themselves and can't believe that they ever participated in that kind of online culture. But I think between that and just the idea of having everything online and being a conflicted teenage, young 20s girl, like, it would be bad enough if someone published what I thought about myself and what I wrote about my life when I was a little younger. So it's very hard to grasp, like, what that's like as, you know, as she sits still to possibly intake press about what people think of her, and just the note that you included that she was largely ridiculed online after it all happened, or that people didn't take her seriously still. It's like the one thing she thought was going to grant her some sort of social pass, and it didn't. No matter, even if it had happened, who knows if it would have.
That's, like, one of the things that I think is, like, so, one of the really, like, complicated and, like, tragic, there's so many tragic legacies to the Columbine shootings, but this idea that, like, the way that we the media, we society kind of accidentally, inadvertently mythologize those two shooters, and then all of these kids now who think, like, I'm going to participate in that mythology, and we have so many shootings now that, like, most of them don't even make the national news. You know, like, there's something, there's, like, so many layers of, like, bleakness there.
That is a very hard topic. I know reading that, I've had a lot of exposure, not to, like, as Olivia typed throughout our script, hashtag Columbiners, every time it occurred. Not necessarily in reading anything that those people put online themselves, but in, like, reading about the phenomenon or observing it on Twitter. Like, if you search on social media any hashtag related to Columbine, it still is posts fantasizing about it, glorifying it, or glorifying the alternative narrative of the two young women who lost their lives and said, yes, they believe in God. And just thinking about, like, how we grew up, like, absolutely dipped in the culture of, that's going to happen to you someday. Like, that's where it started. Viewing that as an adult now and seeing how kids that are younger than us at the time still reach into that bucket to be like, what's in here to validate me? How can this make me feel better? Or clearly they're seeing something inside that violence that they think makes them validated or makes them feel good. And that was just like going through all of that, the text message conversations back and forth were just like, how, what, what is happening?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's, the figures that, like, become our, like, the how many murderers have become national, not quite heroes, but, like, mythological figures, I think. And that's what we do with our myths, right? We define ourselves against them or imagine ourselves as them or try to live through them in some way. And yeah, we got a lot of murderers in that, in America, a lot of those people are murderers.
Definitely.
It's like the same thing, just, I mean, knowing their names and not the victims' names. You know, most people, I mean, everyone knows Ted Bundy's name, but could they name even one of his victims' names? Like, probably not, most people.
Totally. But, you know, and I agree with that, but then I also, there is a part of me that resists, at least personally, like, resists the way of, instead of making crime all about the murderer, then, like, making it all about the victim, because I'm sort of like, the victim didn't ask for all of the scrutiny on her life, you know? And there's, like, so mm-hmm. often, I think even the media that has the best of intentions of, like, not doing victim blaming by turning the spotlight on her, usually, is that's, like, how it plays out, and it's the stories that, like, become kind of media fodder. You just always get people picking apart, like, why were they hitchhiking? Why did they do this? Why did they do that? And I almost, like, there's a part of, I'll say this now on the podcast, if I'm murdered by a serial killer, like, I don't want that to be the main fact of my life. Like, I don't want that to be what people know about me. I don't know. And I don't want everybody sort of finding my life fascinating, like, because I got murdered, or, like, finding my life worthy of dissecting, you know, because somebody committed violence against me. I don't know. And that's why I think that's, like, the thing that a lot of true crime media, like you guys and You're Wrong About, and a lot of other writers are trying to not just look at the murderer, look at the victim, but, like, look at society and look at these, like, bigger things that are, like, turning the lens not on the individual, but on these, like, bigger picture structures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that's big Twitter culture these days, to be like, no, it's about the victim. And it's like, we still don't know what they want. Like, if their parents said no, they don't mm-hmm. want to talk to the TV show about it, we don't talk about it either. There's yeah. a lot of back and forth. And actually, I'm going to skip the next question that we had and move straight into the one underneath it, because here I go again. The episodes of You're Wrong About that you're on, I think my favorite is the Victims' Rights Movement episode. And that is an aspect of true crime that's often overlooked. We tend not to question what's fair or just for someone who is convicted in favor of what we want to say is justice for the victim. So, and that was me, like, the whole time we put together the episodes, particularly about the Tate family, that, like, when you make these broad assertions and these overarching, like, these moves to try to get one family or one person that, you know, maybe that's you and your family and it meant so much to you to gain some sort of foothold in that arena. And then all of a sudden there's 10 cases behind it where that actually doesn't benefit anyone, or it makes things significantly worse for someone else's family. Was the research that you did about the victims' rights movement solely for Savage Appetites, or was that coming into play from somewhere else?
Oh God, I've been, like, fascinated with that whole era for a long time. That's, like, yeah, that's way before I ever thought of writing a book. That was a realm, this idea of, a movement that came out of feminism that is about, or at least started out as being about, like, how can we better support, victims of crime, victims of sexual assault, particularly, people who have traditionally not been treated well by the justice system, and then how that gets twisted and perverted in this way, I would say, to be used as a weapon, like a rhetorical weapon, like, oh, we have to do this on behalf of the victim, this is what victims need, and then gets used to enact these, like, laws and policies that actually just further punish the most the more vulnerable parts of our society. They get, you know, weaponized against brown and black people, other, like, crime victims who don't get to fit into, like, you know, Ronald Reagan's conception of, like, who's a quote unquote innocent victim. All of that. And there's just something that, was so, I don't know. That's just, like, a really sad thing about, recent American culture, like, the way that our words and our best intentions and our, and the policies that we fight for, if we're not really careful, can get like twisted and co-opted and like put to bad use. And it's just also a good lesson in how there's so much focus, like you were just saying, like the Twitter focus on like, well, you've got to, you know, like acknowledge the victims, like things like that. We have to be careful. I think we definitely have to be very aware of our language. But we can't only, I guess, be aware of like our language and our rhetoric. And we also have to be so careful of like the policies, I guess, that get put in place, and something can have like use all the right words and talk about empowering and uplifting and centering victims, and can be like super punitive, bad laws that will like hurt more people than it helps. And so it's not enough to just like have the right language. We have to like think about what that language is doing and who's like using it and why. And so I don't know. There's like I haven't been able to convince anybody to let me write about this, but there's a billionaire. I think he's a billionaire. He's certainly like a multimillionaire who's out there trying to get, new victims' rights laws. He wants there to be a constitutional amendment. But everybody's like, that's not going to happen. So he's trying to get it passed like state by state by state by state. And, he started in like sort of like states that were kind of cheap, like South, like the Dakotas, he did it. You know, just, I think he thought his money would go a long way maybe. And, he himself, his sister was murdered, I think by her ex-boyfriend. And then he like went on to make a ton of money. Which he's spending on this, and it's sort of like a one person advocacy thing. It's kind of wild to look at because you're just like, wow, one guy can like get a law, get a constitutional amendment passed in a state. Like that's pretty intense. Henry Nichols is his name, but he, and Marcy's Law is like the policy. And in a lot of these states where they try to pass it, both the like the DA's office, like the prosecutors association and the defenders association are both like, we don't like this law. This is not a good law, but it totally, he's like masterful at like pulling on the heartstrings, and people are like, victims rights. Like, of course we want that. And so it keeps in most states, it's been passing. But then it's so fascinating because he also has like a ton of, he has some somewhat scandalous drug conviction.
Yes, I've read about this. I was wondering if it was the same thing.
Yeah, but you would never, but I don't think in his conception of, you know, crime being a criminal, like, oh, that's not me, this like billionaire guy with like, who, you know, I can't remember. There's like some wild story about him in Vegas with just like suitcases full of drugs and like, you know, a sex worker who like was like passed out and like maybe, you know, in severe medical distress or something. Like that's not what he means by a criminal, you know, like.
Yes. It's that cut and dry, like a woman was hurt and now we can use it too, which, you know, like in his perspective, fine. That's what he needs. So if that's like what he thinks is going to bring that sense of justice or closure, that's so interesting too.
Yeah, it's just
consider.
Like, it's really fascinating to watch it sort of spread through the country and these things that we sort of, you know, the satanic panic. It's like, I thought we figured that out in like the early 90s. No, we're trying to do it again. You know, the victims' rights stuff. Like, we thought we sort of like kind of got our heads around that. But like, no, I think it's all coming back. It's like this retro. It's like all the kids on TikTok wearing 90s outfits.
Yes, yes. I was just going to say, like, every time a decade of fashion passes us by and comes around again, then the same panics that happened and the same, like, moral issues or legal issues start to, like, repeat themselves with the clothes. right now, a lot of people on my social media have been shocking me with how many of my own 30-year-old friends are feeling like it's problematic that Lil Nas X has a video where he gives Satan a lap dance, and I'm just like, what? Like, you guys, that's not, one, this is not like a literal representation of the underworld and Satan. It's, you need to read about the video and watch it a couple more times and understand that we're not proclaiming that anyone who's in hell giving a lap dance is worshiping. That's not what any of this is. I was just shocked to have that come around, and I expected to laugh with a bunch of people about it, and they were like, I don't know, I go to church now a little bit and that's weird to me. And I was just like, what?
So can you tell us about any of the cases that you maybe wanted to cover in Savage Appetites, but for whatever reason, you know, didn't make the cut, or any that you kind of wanted to cover more in depth, that kind of those side cases that you mentioned and covered briefly, but not as in depth as some of the other ones.
Let me see. I'm trying to think. It's funny, like, I had to get kind of ruthless with my brain, and I would be like, well, we're cutting that. I guess that's, can't think about that anymore. I mean, I wanted, if I had gotten to have a fifth section of the book, I would have really loved to write about maybe like the archetype of the journalist or the writer and focus on Anne Rule. I think like she's so fascinating as a character, as a true crime writer, you know, first in the trenches, you know, making no money writing for True Detective magazine, and then having the, you know, luck question mark to befriend Ted Bundy, and that made her career. And I don't know. I think her relationship with the idea of like writing true crime, but trying to center the victim, but also being like totally in cahoots with law enforcement because they were her sources. I think she was a really fascinating person and would have been like so interesting to learn more about. And I think she, you know, before she died, it seemed like there was some complicated stuff going on in her family and some estrangement. And I don't know. I think there probably was a lot there if I had had a chance to dig into it, but I didn't. And I also remember the victim section had like a whole long, this is not a case, but a whole long digression about V.C. Andrews. Did you guys read that? Like,
yes.
What is it called? Like the children in the attic. What are they?
Yes.
Yes. Some flowers in the attic.
Flowers, yeah. Flowers yeah. in the attic. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And just like that to me is like this very like weirdly sexy literature of victimization, you know, if you want to talk about like the very strange and multi-layered and complex and contradictory ways that like victimhood is conceptualized in our culture. I think like digging into her and her life and like what she did with those books is, there's just a lot there. So I definitely had like a few week period where I was like, well, I need to read at least five of these books and like read all about her life and like try to feel it, see if I could go see her papers. And then it was clear that I was like, okay, maybe that's an entirely different project, but I think it ties in, you know, and the like, yeah, the violence and the abuse and the being saved and then being, you know, punished and all of that stuff. It's like, I think probably if you surveyed a lot of true crime fans, the like true crime fascination and the V.C. Andrews, it's like I bet a lot of us had a middle school V.C. Andrews phase.
Yes.
I can't prove that scientifically, but I would bet money on it.
I would say there's a lot of crossover between people like us now in their 30s and people who read V.C. Andrews and Stephen King way too young.
Yes.
For sure.
That is, I was like some of the fiction that we talked about in the process of it, because I think we were, you know, quarantined. We had just been watching TV constantly and reevaluating those kind of like teenagery shows. Like we were both watching Pretty Little Liars as we were reading the book and having this. I mean, I was an adult the first time I watched it, or at least, you know, late teen, early 20s, and some of the madness that happens in that book. That's like this. Clearly, we're not coming from a point of reality as far as legality, like what laws are being broken, how someone's going to get caught or not caught doing something. But it was very interesting to kind of apply this focus of who is dying in this season, who's dying in this scene, how are we treating her, what does the audience get out of, you know, Allison getting hit by a shovel, or was it Allison? Is Allison alive? And it's kind of this perfect, I mean, that's the type of book genre that I'm stuck in still as a 30-year-old woman. I just finished the Truly Devious series and I can't stop telling people about it. It's like clearly for 15-year-olds.
I'm gonna write like that. Truly Devious?
Yes. I want to say that the author's name is Maureen Johnson. Let's look.
I mean, as humans, we love a melodrama, you know? And that's the thing. Like, that's where I try. Like, sometimes when I would be talking to people about this book, they'd be like, oh, tell me, like, what's the good and morally acceptable true crime? And I was like, no, that's not what I want. Like, this genre can never be oatmeal, you know? It doesn't, like, that's just, that's not right. That's not what it's for. It's more just like, it can, it's just like, consume it, but then have more interesting thoughts about it, you know, while you're consuming it, I guess is how I feel. Like, don't deny yourself the melodrama. Don't deny yourself the intensity of reading about it, the extremes of human experience. Like, of course we're curious about those things. We're humans. We want to understand, like, the edge cases of humanity, but just consume them with, like, a questioning and curious and critical mind, I think, is, for me, it's so.
But. Yeah, I think it comes down a lot to, like, the kind of person reading it. Like, what, you know, why are you here? What are you hoping to get out of it all over again? And that's giving me a lot of, like, realizations about myself. Like, actually, in the moment, I used to read, like, I would seek out all kinds of books that, you know, had a memoir quality from a murderer. I read The Creation of a Serial Killer by Keith Hunter Jesperson when I was, like, 12 and did an episode on the book. But I remember reading it when I was young and being like, this is bad, so I love it. If anyone knew I was reading this, I would be in trouble. And then I was like 25 and was like, ew, what the fuck was I putting inside myself, like reading about this stuff when I could have been outside playing at recess? And now, coming back to it again, it's like, no, that's fine. Read that. Know what he thinks about himself. And then also read about reporters who reported on him and find out what's not true. Because, you know, there's no way to read something where, you know, in a situation like that, where the writer is a serial killer, admittedly, to take in that content without being like, okay, what are you lying about?
Right. Right. Why do you want me to see you in this way?
Yeah. The same, another instance of motivation that gets brought to the table.
Totally.
I think my last one, I had another one on here, once again, with the you're wrong about quote.
It's just so good.
I can't get enough. I really can't. In fact, after I heard, or no, I want to say, now that I'm saying this, I'll correct myself and say the first time I heard about the book was from Lainey Hobbs on True Crime Fan Club podcast.
Oh, cool.
And then, and then on You're Wrong About. But on another one of the episodes, Michael Hobbs says, we end up prioritizing crimes that have a high emotional impact. And we kind of talked about this, but I think I emotionally sat the longest with Lori Davis and her story, just because, like you said, I think it was because there's an element of, we get something right now, even though we just said nothing gets wrapped up with a bow. Like, the whole journey here was brutal, but at the very end, you do get, like, a little bit of, thank God something went right for someone. And just, like, that she is not the type of person, as I was reading about her, that I thought would get any publicity in favor of other stories who, like, about women who end up in relationships with a high-profile defendant. So how, like, why was it her? Was it just the, you know, the background and what led her to that? Or, you know, what comparisons can be made, as I did in the series with, you know, like, collecting stories, hearing about women who write to serial killers or murderers is one of the, like, niches that I find myself in constantly, and being like, why are you doing that? What can I learn by reading about you, or what are you getting about this? So I think her story definitely came to me as, like, this is definitely the one that we never would have heard about because it's so nice.
Right. Yeah. I think that was part of it, is like, so yeah, those, yeah, like, women writing to prisoners, it's just like this very, it is really fascinating, but it also is, like, so pathologized. That's what everybody thought I was writing about when I said I was writing, you know, a book about women and true crime. They'd be like, oh, women writing, women who fall in love with prisoners. And wow, there is a cultural obsession with those stories. But I think Lori's story, well, I'll tell you the, like, part of it was just, that I knew that there was, like, a lot of material out there before I even reached out to her. So that's just, like, the reporter, the strategic, like, writerly answer is, like, well, you need a story where there is some material that you can go to, whether it's, like, the court transcript from Lindsay, from Lindsay's chats, or it's, you know, somebody's archival papers, Francis Lesner Lee's, like, letters, you know, at the Harvard Medical School archive or something. Like, you just need, if you're trying to, like, get a sense of what a person's experience is, like, you need something to go on. And so I knew, I had been really, I had, like, read those the letters. There's a book of the letters that she and Damien wrote to each other over the course of their relationship, when most of it happened over letters. And it's just the most romantic book. I read it and it stuck with me. And it's, if you're a person who at all enjoys like 19th century novels, I feel like it hits a similar, or it scratches a similar itch, because you're just sort of like, oh, these people, it's like hard for these people to get together. You know, they're just these very intense obstacles, but they're just falling in love through the written word. And they're both so eloquent and just really like honestly describe their experience over a long period of time. So that was really interesting to me. And then when I reached out to her, I don't know, I think honestly, I probably thought there was like something more dark or twisted there. I don't know what, I don't think that I like had a sense of what I thought it was. But then when I just met her and I was like, oh, she's just a good person. Oh, this is making me think I should text her and see how she's doing. But we mostly communicate through like texting each other pictures of our cats.
Perfection.
It was like, I was really lucky because I didn't know, I had no idea whether she was going to talk to me or not. And she's not on social media. So, you know, I got the contract. I signed this contract. I was like, all right, I'm going to write this book. She's one of my four subjects. I have no idea whether she's going to talk to me. I have no idea whether I can like find her. Usually I'm pretty good at like the Google sleuthing, as I'm sure, you know, you guys are in like Instagram and everything, but I was like, she's not out there. And it was one of those, tricky situations where like somebody has gotten so much press that it makes it harder to find them in a way, you know, cause you just find all the like news articles and you're just like, but where are you? And she's never been on social media. And I was like, I'm not, how can I even ask her if I can talk to her if I can't find her? But I did a good, I like very fortunately had like a friend of a friend of a friend who like passed on an email. And it just happened to arrive to her at the time when, she and Damien were like in a really good solid place. And she told me, she was like, you know, if you had emailed me 6 months earlier, I would have said no, because like things were really bad then. And it's only right now, like it's only that it was right now that you reached out that I would have agreed. And that to me, was really miraculous and fortunate, because I think that, you know, I could have built that story without talking to her. But hearing her and meeting the both of them, the two of them, and seeing it, I think, I don't know, just gave it a whole other dimension. So, like a mixture of accident and luck, and coincidence and circumstance.
That's the best stories. Those are all the good ingredients for like things coming together and getting such a good result out of something that, you know, would have been fantastic either way, but then to have that extra, like, it's so truly her, even though it's through your writing, to get this sense of, like, what she's like as a person. And to contrast that to, I mean, like, the big piece that came out at the time that we also talked about in that section was the, you know, in my head, nearly identical story of that, the article, The Journalist and the Pharma Bro, of... When that came out and I read it and then I read the book, I was like, this is the same. Very different endings. But I was just like, what is this? That feels like another one of these things that I want to poke at and be like, what's that?
Or did you read that article that just came out, I think in New York Magazine, about Sarah Gruen, the woman who wrote, like,
yeah,
what
yes.
are...
Yes.
Yes.
I mean,
they sent that to me.
I almost tweeted about it, and then I was like, this poor lady, I don't, like... I hope she figures it out. But again, it's like this, it read as this story of like writer's block, procrastination, you know, like the most amazing form of procrastination is just like, now I'm going to dedicate my life to like getting this guy off death row. And that's a really good excuse to not write, honestly. Like,
yes,
you know, that is more important, I guess. But it's, yeah, just that motif of like, I'm going to sacrifice myself because that's what I've been socialized is like a good thing to do, and really like use myself up for this abstract sense of justice. Yeah. But it did make me upset that everybody was like, oh, she must be in love with him or something. And I was just like, no, maybe she's in love with some idea of justice, but that doesn't seem like what.
Yes. When I texted it to Olivia, it was like one of the quotes from her in the article was like, no, I don't care about this one thing more than the other. It's just, can we not treat him like a fucking human being? Yeah. Like, this is how I would want someone to show up for me. So this is what I'm doing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then I think the rest of it, you know, how is it, you know, it just happened to be that he wrote to her and she got the letter and she felt like writing back. All of those tiny circumstances playing out in the same way, you know, the same way that Frances Glessner Lee was like, I have a bunch of money. What do you want to do? I'm interested.
Yeah.
When
I've had that experience myself, I've had a handful of times like corresponding with somebody in prison, and there is something really fascinating about like getting messages from this world that we don't have visibility to, you know, that we're blocked, I think, for many reasons. Like, people were intentionally not shown what happens in prison, and that's a world that's not supposed to be visible to the outside world. But it does have this interesting charge to it that is not romantic, but has energy, you know? So there's like also, I think, that part of me that like understood that experience.
Yeah, that's something we talked about with Jax Miller too. And I think that's like a universal concept kind of probably less and less so as a writer when you start to have that experience for yourself. But I think like hearing you talk about it, hearing her talk about it, and then other authors or writers that we've talked to who have had that experience, it's very much described in the same way of like, there is that feeling of like, you know, maybe the first couple times it happens, you're like, this has promise, or like, this is going to be something big. Like, the minute you get access to something that otherwise, you know, it's like this prize that you can be like, how, you know, what am I going to do with this asset? How am I going to use this resource that I have that, you know, it's just like unfettered access that you, like you said, you don't get ever. You at least don't get any honest level of what that looks like. Olivia, have we left anything out above in the Savage Appetites section, or did we get to all of it?
I think we covered them all. Taking a quick scan. Yeah. I think we covered them all.
Okay. So do you want to go into your... We had a couple non-related ones, just based on, like, other things that we've read that you've written and interviews and stuff. A couple of, like, non-Savage Appetites questions.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, am I rambling on too long? I'm just like...
Oh no.
Our episodes are regularly 2 hours.
Yeah.
And it can make you sound very sharp. And
So one of my questions from Chris O'Connell's article about you, there's a quote pulled from you that says, I have a weird relationship with attention. It makes me feel very exposed. So obvious, like super relatable, so much relatable. So I hate talking about myself to people. Like on a podcast, it's a different thing because it's like, I'm just talking to Mackenzie in my head, even though I know other people are going to listen. But like, if I were to stand up in front of people and talk about me or what I've done, oh my gosh, no. It would be so much anxiety inducing. So kind of how do you balance that, especially now that your book is out? Because at the time of this article, your book wasn't out yet. And I mean, your book is a huge success. So kind of how do you balance that feeling?
Thank you for saying it's a huge success. I'll accept that. It's funny. I think I do like, my trick, I guess, is like a kind of sleight of hand almost, where it's like there are these, first person parts of the book and the parts where I'm talking about myself. And in other kinds of writing that I've done, I also like, I think that's something that, that was one of those things I thought like a reporter wasn't allowed to do. Like you can't use I, you know, like they tell you in 7th grade or something. But I feel like I've had editors who've allowed me to use the I a lot, but looking back at it, a lot of it is not really actually all that personally revealing. Like, I'll tell you sort of about what I'm thinking, but not necessarily, and sometimes what I'm feeling, but not necessarily like personal details, mm-hmm. really, about like my family or my life situation or, you know, and usually it's like I use myself as like another refraction of the story itself. So I think that's like a classic reporter trick in a way, is to deflect away from the self and to like be like, don't pay attention to me, I'm very boring. Pay attention to, like, you know, this murderer, you know? and like, that's certainly much more exciting than me. And so I think that's been, I don't know, maybe it's a good adaptation of a way of like avoiding, so even if I'm up in front of people talking about the book or being interviewed or whatever, usually I'm not actually talking too much about myself, or if I'm talking about myself, it's like how I found a story or how, you know, it's, mm-hmm. It's a little bit of like a sleight of hand maybe. And that, I guess, makes me feel comfortable about it, because the things that I write about, I usually get really excited about. And so it makes me feel less self-conscious and less exposed and less like fearful. Cause all I want, I'm just like, oh my God, I would love to tell you about, you know, the kidnap and ransom industry, which is what I'm researching right now. Like I could, my fascination with it like transcends my fear of, exposure or visibility or something in a way.
Okay.
But like, don't ask me about my romantic life or anything.
Those are sleight of hand, and then the other bit you said, like if it's a transcension of making like something all of a sudden, that is a big relatability factor for me. I can be in a room full of people that I'd have no interest in talking to, but if you bring up one subject that I can't stop talking about, I will quickly run everyone out of the room for like being unable to stop myself. And I think that again comes back to a Michael Hobbesism, talking about personality journalism and how that's such a big thing now, and people have presence in what they write. And I think that's my favorite way to consume media. That's another, like, I know I will like something if the author says I, and they reveal any slight backstory of like, let me introduce you to how we got to this point in the book. I'm like, okay, I'm done. If you can give me two stories in one, I'm sold.
Exactly. And I think it's interesting to like know how things got made for sure. But I think it's also, to me, it feels much more honest, right? Like I remember one of the first lines I did, I wrote a piece about this guy who's like a pickup artist. And I was just so, as a like straight woman interviewing this guy who was just built his life around like manipulating straight women, I could not hide, I think, my like personal disgust, I think, with what I was trying to understand what he was saying, but I also like, I just had to acknowledge that I was having a physical, visceral reaction of like total exasperation and despair, you know, and it would have been like dishonest, I guess, to like pretend that I was coming to this story in any kind of neutrality. And the story doesn't need to be about that, but it seems like it would have been false, I guess, to not acknowledge that that was like the lens through which I was approaching this story. And it would have been really different if it had been like a queer person talking to him, you know, or like another straight man or something. Like those people would have had a different, everything would have been different. And so it just seemed not only useful, but like really important, I guess, to acknowledge that.
Yeah. And that feeds right into what I had next. After reading a bunch of your articles and other publications listed on your website, I sent Olivia today, one of my favorite articles is the one that you wrote about the TikTok houses and all of the famous teenagers of the internet, being a 30-year-old person who just got on TikTok in the last like 5 months. It was fascinating to read about how they treat each other, how they approach work, just like what it's like to be 21 and have access to a mansion.
It's just wild for those kids. It's such a strange world. And that was like one of the interviews that I got most nervous about, interviewing Charli D'Amelio, because I was like, she's so famous. But that was just because I had been researching this story. And if you're not like a 17-year-old girl, then there are a lot of, it's this very odd bifurcated kind of fame where it's like a lot of people have no idea who she is. And there's like, she has more TikTok followers than like live in the United Kingdom. You know, you have no idea how famous she is, but she's also like not that famous. I don't know. But I was so nervous.
That's a good analogy of how we approach interviewing authors. To us, it's like every time we wake up and interview authors, I'm like, holy shit, I'm meeting a celebrity today. Whoa. So that was kind of like the pre-question or like the pre-topic. So based on everything that interests you enough to write about it, what are you reading right now? I feel like you probably have great taste in books.
I mean, I wish that I had great, I mean, maybe, I think I used to have great taste in books, but now I have this problem. I mean, it's an asset and a problem at the same time. Like whenever I'm reporting on something, I like way, way, way over research. And then I never have time to read fun books, but I am reading a fun book right now, but it's for research. I'm just obsessed with the kidnap and ransom industry. And I'm reading a book called, I believe it's called Kidnap, from like from 1993 maybe. And it's just all about these like professional negotiators and the rise of, kidnap and ransom insurance and all of this stuff. Like these strange little corners of the world that like, you know, a month ago I'd never heard of. And now, and I'm not even writing, I'm writing about ransomware. So like boring computer hacker stuff. But I was like, ransomware, that leads me to ransom, which leads me to kidnapping. And now I need to read like 6 books about like the history of kidnapping, you know, kidnapping during the Crusades, like the Barbary pirates. I need to read about, you know, professional kidnap negotiators. Like I need to read about cyber attacks. So I'm reading a bunch of good books, but they're all like for work.
Still counts. I feel like that's how if I give myself any kind of quota to read a book throughout the year, they all end up being related to the genre. Actually, I think we have...
Tonight, I'm going to read this Truly Devious book.
Oh, it's so good. I blew through all of them.
Yeah.
They were... they're all pretty short. I have them on ebook, so I'm not really sure how long they are, but... It is a delightful boarding school cozy murder mystery with a 16-year-old protagonist who is going to solve a 100-year-old cold case.
Oh my god, I love a boarding school anything. I just love boarding school content.
Yes.
So this is really...
Boarding school content leads to lack of authority and lots of rule breaking, so it's just infinite possibilities.
Right, like a teen society, you know? That's what the TikTok thing is, too. Like, what if you guys created your own society? And it turns out it's terrifying.
Yes, I agree. So my last question is, our next series is on the book Yellowbird by Sierra Crane Murdoch. I'm not finished with it yet, but so far it's been absolutely impossible to separate it in my head from Savage Appetites. So if you have read it... do you have feelings on it? What's it like to read that and then think about your own work?
I love that book. I think that book is so incredible. We met for coffee, I think, before either of us had finished our books. And I'm just so in awe of Sierra. She just has like a really wonderful presence. You guys should definitely talk to her. It was one of those books that like made me, I both, felt, what was it? Because it wasn't quite envy. I felt so in awe of the reporting that she put into it and the depth of her reporting. And I guess, like, my brain, I really like to make connections. And so I like to be like, V.C. Andrews and, you know, the history of victims' rights and, like, Ronald Reagan and, you know, like, just Charles Manson and Sharon Tate and, like, you know, going all over the place and being, like, sort of... seeing or inventing like webs between these people. But it can feel really like broad and spread out. And I feel like Sierra with that book, what's so incredible is the amount of time and like the patience that she had to write it, and that she did not sort of, it's like the opposite of helicopter journalism or whatever, like parachute journalism. Like she just embedded herself and she just kept going back and she learned so much. And it's just such a, it makes it such a rich book. And I admire that so much. I think that's like, there's a part of me, there's a big part of me that like wants to be more like that. And so I just, you know, wanted to like sit at her feet and be like, teach me how to be like you.
That is absolutely how I feel so far about it. It's been, it's such a shift to go from reading, you know, one book that has multiple parts, lots of players, and then this book also has lots of parts and players, but everyone is interwoven, and I found myself having to backtrack and being like, wait, who's this person? I can't remember what the connection is here. And then learning, like, of course, this is a big, you know, we've never really put a lot of thought into what books we pick. We just have a running list of, like, we like this one, this one, this one, and this one, so we're going to pick those. But this year we were like, let's put a little more effort into it. So learning about, like, Native American culture and that whole aspect of it, like, sorry to our listeners, you're going to get so much backstory that really has nothing to do with the central crime of the story, but, like, all of that interconnected stuff that happens to understand the context, like, given that deep, deep history.
Totally.
That the way you described, too, the way she, like, immersed herself in it and then presented without leaving one thing out is incredible.
And it's such a smart way to think about true crime, I guess, because you, like, hook the reader with the crime that they think that they want to read about. Like, ooh, you know, a man went missing. How, like, will they find him? But then you realize, like, oh, this book. And then it seems like, why is she going on all these digressions about, you know, the oil and gas industry and like the history of like land expropriation. And then you're like, oh wait, these are all crimes. Like these are, there's like a whole history of crimes here, you know, about the extractive economy and the way that land was stolen. And like, there's like so many more crimes than the like crime that you think that you came to want to read about that like make up this whole world that allowed this like one man to go missing. But it's all in there. So great. I can't wait to hear.
Good. I'm excited. We also have Leslie Rule's book on our list to do this season. So if she doesn't want to talk to us, maybe we can call you back and talk about her book and Anne Rule for a while.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That was the end of the questions that we had on our list. Olivia, do you have anything that like came up outside of that?
No, I'm really excited to finish Yellowbird now. Not that I wasn't before, but now I'm even more excited. I just want to, like, go read it right now.
Is there
a lot of the, like, really good, like, the meta stuff? I just remember these parts where she's, like, in the hotel room with, what's her name? Is her name Lisa?
I don't know if it's Lisa or Lisa.
Lisa, yeah, she's like in the hotel room with her and you're just like, oh, this seems so stressful, like Sierra is. And I don't know, it's really like the you get a sense of like, I feel like she does a really good job of that very subtle strategic use of the eye where you're like, I don't know. It's really very well done.
I'm excited to finish it. I just texted Olivia last night. I was like, I'm 60% of the way done with this, and there's, like, no mention of the main case quote. So I was like, I'm excited to see where this goes in the last half of the book. Mm-hmm.
Good thing you don't like closure.
Good.
There's some closure.
Well, Rachel, is there anything else about Savage Appetites or about anything that we've asked you or topics that have come up that you would like to talk about?
I can't think of anything. This was like so fun. What a real treat. So I feel like I've just been at a nice Zoom happy hour or something.
Good. That's our goal. That's the vibe we try to set. Always letting everyone in the room know that we're the least professional people here, so everyone else is good. Where can people go buy your book?
People can buy my book at their local independent bookstore, bookshop.org, or, you know, Also, any evil conglomerate out there?
Perfect way to put it. Well, we thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. This was a big section in our history of our podcast. I think we we've had a lot of side conversation about like what's going to happen next, how are we going to change how we present our content, and like what is the most meaningful way that we can come at this and, you know, use this small platform that people have given us
and just do better with how we've been researching.
Well, that's like really incredible to hear, and thank you so much for the like thoughtful and focused attention that you've given it. It's like really, it really is. It's, I don't know. It's how everybody dreams of being read. So
since we can't write, that's our goal.
Awesome. Well, let me know if you need anything else. Like, or yeah, let me know if there's anything else.
Awesome. We will. Again, thank you for coming on and talking to us. We're excited for our listeners to hear all of this.
Yeah. Thanks for doing it, and have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Bum 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 b